We've had more than our share of bridges like that. As we collect our social media photographs of yardsticks stuck into backyard snow drifts, we didn't want to miss out on a very important anniversary, the 40th anniversary of a big windstorm on this very day, a windstorm so big it sank half of the original Hood Canal floating bridge. Yes, that floating bridge you travel these days is the second Hood Canal 2.0, the one that floats. And here is our Wednesday visit with resident historian Felix Bunnell.
Yeah, we do have a checkered past when it comes to bridges giving up the ghost. The original Tacoma Narrows Bridge famously collapsed back in 1940. The Skagit River Bridge was damaged and failed in 2013. And, of course, the Lacey V. Murrow Bridge on Lake Washington sank in 1990. And 40 years ago, this very day, the western portion of the original Hood Canal Bridge broke free and sank after a night of battering by high winds and strong currents. Now, this bridge had opened back in 1961. That's 2 years before the original 520 bridge and 21 years after the original I-90 bridge. It cost just $25 million to build, which would be like $210 million today. So on the night of February 12, 1979, we had one of those classic Puget Sound wind events where a low-pressure system moved across the region just north of Puget Sound and essentially drained all the air from western Washington like a massive bathtub. There were trees down and power outages all over the place. WashDOT crews on the Hood Canal Bridge closed to vehicle traffic around 11 p.m. and opened the draw span to relieve pressure. Around 6 a.m., the wind was gusting over 100 miles per hour. Now, those floating pontoons made of concrete began taking on water around 6:40 a.m. About 7:15 a.m., that western section, this would be pontoons A through M if you're keeping score here. Each of those are 360 feet long. They broke loose, shifted to the north, rolled over, and sank into Hood Canal. And that western high-rise hinged down into the water, but it stayed attached. Now, this was many years before what we now call social media. This was in the days when local radio was the only social media. You know, the only way you could get a 24-hour social media update was to call your local radio station. Now, over on the Olympic Peninsula that windy morning, 31-year-old Jim McDonald was on duty at Port Angeles' adult contemporary powerhouse, KONP 1450. The ONP stands for Olympic National Park, which is pretty cool. It's a whole other story. Anyway, Jim was the announcer, and news director Neil Clement was in the middle of a newscast when the KONP listener line started ringing.
And so I answer the phone, and it's Marge Perrott. Marge is a loyal listener and a friend of ours. And she tells me, she says, you know, my sister lives above the Hood Canal Bridge. And she just called me and said, the bridge has sunk. You know, and my first thought is, no. Seriously? And she said, yeah. She said, the bridge is gone. And so I said, well, okay, Marge, we'll follow up on that.
Now, Jim eventually bought KONP and KAPY, the other station in Port Angeles, and ran it for 20 years. But he's retired now, but he vividly remembers that morning of February 13th, 1979. He got that tip from his friend Marge, but he couldn't go on the air with just a rumor.
When the news director got off the air, I told him about the call, and he called the Port Angeles detachment of the State Patrol. And as you might expect, they were in the throes of the whole thing, too. But they did confirm to us that a portion of the bridge had gone down, and they were still trying to figure out how much of the bridge had gone down and all sorts of other things because their office was going crazy.
Yeah, unfortunately, nobody was injured or killed when the bridge went down, but newspaper accounts at the time say four or five passenger cars and a semi-truck barely made it off the section before it sank. Those cars and trucks had been waiting for the bridge to open. One of the WashDOT guys interviewed by the Seattle Times blamed a Jefferson County sheriff's deputy for not staying on the scene to keep people off the bridge. That semi-truck driver apparently had a heck of a time backing up. They even brought him back when the new bridge opened in 1982, a guy named Red Taylor. He was the first guy across. Anyway, back in Port Angeles early that morning, it turned out that KONP got the biggest scoop in the station's history.
I mean, we probably had it on the air confirmed, you know, within 15 minutes of the bridge going down. You know, we were at our 7 o'clock newscast when I got the phone call from Marge. And so we were probably on the air with the situation confirmed, you know, probably by 7:15, 7:20, something like that.
So, yeah, happy World Radio Day, by the way. KONP brought in extra people to handle the phone calls that day, but the bigger impact to the region took a while to sink in.
It impacted everybody a lot. You know, it took them a few weeks before they got some ferry service, you know, across the canal. And the ferry service was basically a barge that was pushed across by a tugboat. And until they got that going, the only way you could really get to Seattle was head on down the Hood Canal all the way down to through Shelton and Olympia and back up I-5, or you could go to Bremerton and take a ferry to Seattle. So it really cut off, you know, the peninsula a lot.
So, yeah, that replacement bridge of the western half opened in October 1982. That semi-driver, Red Taylor, was the first guy across. And then in 2009, they replaced the eastern half. So it's a completely brand-new bridge. The old bridge is still there on the bottom of Hood Canal. They chipped away a lot of the dangerous concrete to not hurt the new cables. But that sort of remains down there as a natural fish habitat and monument to this tragedy that no one died or was hurt in 40 years ago.
Yeah. We've been pretty fortunate in our bridge catastrophes, and we're very good at creating that natural fish habitat, unfortunately. So did they ever figure out what, because with the Mercer Island Bridge, the reason it went down was because they had opened the pontoons, they were draining water into it rather than pollute the lake when they were refurbishing it, but what breached the pontoons of the Hood Canal Bridge? Did they crack? Or?
Near as I can tell, it was the really high winds combined with high current and low tides. It had a lot of slack on the cables. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to find that PDF you thought there would be with the postmortem on what happened.
Yeah.
But it seems like it was a combination of high winds for a long time, strong currents, and then those slack cables. And just the thing was 18 years old and just a 50-year-old design at this point, or 60-year-old design.
Yeah. Well, these things are basically giant ships made of concrete.
Yep.
There's a reason you don't make ships out of concrete.
Yeah, it's amazing, though. Nobody was hurt or killed in any of these bridge strategies
we've
had around here.
That's right. Thank you, Felix. Historian Felix Bunnell joins us each Wednesday on Seattle's Morning News, and all his features are at MyNorthwest.com. Seattle's Morning News. Good to have you with us this morning. It was 1 year ago today an 18-year-old was arrested for a school shooting plot in Everett. That teen was supposed to learn his fate yesterday, but there was a delay in sentencing, and Cairo's Hannah Scott has the story.
19-year-old Joshua O'Connor was arrested after his grandmother called police when she found his journal detailing a terrifying Columbine-style plot to use bombs and guns at Aces High School in Everett, where he was a student, to kill as many people as possible. The journal detailed how he planned to use zip ties on the doors and mow down kids in the halls and use bombs to increase the body count. He had just bought a rifle like the one used by the Columbine killers a few weeks earlier when he turned 18 and then used it for an armed robbery at a convenience store to get cash for more guns for his attack. Cops also found homemade explosives in his home. All of that added up to taking significant steps toward carrying out his plan, according to prosecutors, who charged him with attempted murder, armed robbery, and explosives charges. He pled guilty in December and was due to be sentenced yesterday, with prosecutors asking for more than 23 years, but the judge delayed a decision after hearing from a new defense witness, Bellevue criminal psychologist Delton Young, who pointed to O'Connor's traumatic childhood and major depression as a mitigating factor. When the judge asked how long it would be before O'Connor was rehabilitated,
my psychological evaluation suggests this is a young man who needs a good bit of time to come to terms with what he has done and what he endured earlier in life, and also to begin to strengthen his own personal self.
O'Connor's grandmother also detailed his troubled childhood, with a mother who would often threaten to kill herself and take the kids with her and leave the teen and his younger sisters without food and water. The grandmother also talked about how she eventually brought him to live with her, his increasing drug use and drinking, and eventually the reason she called police.
I don't believe school shootings happen there's other signs that people see, and I believed I was seeing it.
You believed you were seeing signs that your own grandson was...
I believed I was seeing signs that he needed help.
But she also talked about how much the two love one another and visit regularly now and asked the judge for leniency. At the end of the hearing, the judge gave O'Connor the chance to speak, and he apologized to his friends, family, and the community for his actions and said he was ready to serve his time, but said he also has plans, including his GED and continuing his education behind bars.
My understanding that they have programs in which I can get certified and certificates and many job fields. I plan on taking full advantage of many of these opportunities. Also, I'm going to join the dog training program, and I plan on pursuing my passion for advanced music theory and guitar. I hope my music will be a source of therapy for other inmates. As for my long-term goal, I hope to eventually write a biography about my life and struggles. And I hope by accomplishing this, I touch the lives of many people.
He also thanked his grandmother for turning him in.
And Hannah joins us live now. Of course, this is not the only young man who's had a horrible childhood. Was there any more explanation as to how the way he was raised led him to want to act it out in the form of a school shooting?
Just that he had become fascinated, right, with the Columbine killers. I believe he had looked up history and had books on not just the Columbine shooters, but also the Oklahoma bomber. In fact, the journals detailed the date of his attack would have been last April 19th, mm-hmm. which falls right in between the anniversary of the Oklahoma bombing and the Columbine shooting. Of course, he was arrested several weeks before that, so that never happened. But they did, the point you just brought up, he has two younger sisters, so they painted this picture of his mother, his very abusive mother, and the two younger sisters, where they were left alone, and he was the eldest, right? So he had to take care of them, and I think they called it parentified. So he had this sense of looking out for the younger sisters, and they eventually got separated because the grandmother brought him to live here, and the two sisters stayed behind. But those two sisters, they did not grow up to plot school shootings and do similar actions. So it was definitely a point that was brought up in court yesterday.
Did the grandmother have any qualms? Did she have to wrestle with herself before going to the police, knowing that it would obviously lead to her grandson's arrest?
And she did. She didn't speak yesterday, other than on the court, on the witness stand. But I know back when this first happened, she said, you know, it was a hard decision. But as you just heard in her soundbite right there, she knew there was something wrong. She found this journal, which was absolutely terrifying. The things that were written in this journal were very, very detailed about the way he wanted to kill people, the body count he wanted, the way he wanted to trap people to lure police out and also try to attack them. She was legitimately concerned, and that outweighed any concern she might have for, you know, turning her grandson in, because she, again, as she said, there are school shootings that happen where people have missed the signs. She did not want to be that person.
Now, obviously, from what I heard in your report, he seemed very contrite, of course, but there's got to be some sort of rehabilitation here. So will the sentence account for that? What form would that take?
There would certainly be counseling and things like that. I'm sure that should he be in jail, this would be adult prison, right? He's now 19 years old. And you heard him talk about he wants to do a variety of different educational things there. We're talking about a significant difference in time. I didn't mention in the report. So the prosecution is asking here for 23 and a half years.
Wow.
He was pled guilty to attempted murder. Because remember, he did the armed robbery at the convenience store to get more money to fund for his attack.
Right.
So that's, you know, and then he also had homemade explosives at home, which were also part of the plot. All of that adds up to that taking significant steps. So he's also charged with attempted murder there. The defense attorney said that he, because of all these mitigating factors, the childhood, the development of his brain, because he was only 18 at the time, his brain wasn't fully developed, so he didn't really understand the consequences, was kind of the defense they were trying to use. So the defense is asking for 12 years. The judge is going to decide on a sentence on the 28th of this month, but there's a huge gap there, right, between 12 to 23 and a half years, almost double.
Right. Kyra is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We've had a measles outbreak in Washington State, and one of the reasons it has spread to over 50 cases at last count is because of a number of people who have not been immunized. And there's legislation to basically eliminate opting out of the vaccination. And it is now pretty clear where the King County Medical Society stands on this. Here is Dr. Teresa Girolami to tell us where they stand. You've decided that the exemptions are no longer advisable. Is that correct?
Yes. Actually, 4 years ago, King County Medical Society sent down a representative to oppose this exact thing about having personal exemptions from vaccinations. And 4 years ago, Olympia voted it down and said, no, we're going to let people have personal exemptions. But now we have a measles outbreak. Over 50 kids around the area and in Oregon are affected. And now suddenly it's urgent and on their radar. Well, thank goodness, because we have always supported vaccinations for all. We don't really believe in personal exemptions because that's not really fair to the rest of the kids in school or your child or your grandchild or somebody else getting measles because somebody else just chose, for whatever their personal reason was, not to have a vaccine. And we've never felt that was okay. Vaccines are one of the number one ways, probably the best way, to prevent any of these kind of contagious diseases. We have measles now, but next year, it could be something else.
Is this a little like an I told you so moment for you?
Yes. And yes. And I'm very proud that we took a stance about it 4 years ago because we were ahead of the curve. And it's always unfortunate that something bad has to happen. And then you're behind the eight ball and trying to catch up. But, you know, harm has already been done. And so once again, we are very supportive. We've always been supportive of vaccines and we don't want to have a death. So, yes, we are out in front of it. And we're sad that they didn't support it the first time and hoping that this time it's going to go through.
I don't need to tell you that there are still some people who, despite the outbreak, are convinced that the vaccines are dangerous. And I heard from one of them who sent me to a study that tried to link deaths to having the vaccine. And while they admitted that there were some deaths that occurred within a few days of getting the vaccine, they pointed out that there is always going to be a certain death rate just through various natural causes. And yet this is the kind of thing that that people will look at and say, well, this proves it's dangerous. So take another swing at this, you know?
Yeah, I would say that's incredibly rare. I mean, you could say that about any pill you ever put in your mouth. You could say that about anything. There's always going to be some rare adverse effect to something. But there's really no proof that there's any terrible adverse effects with getting your child immunized. There are the rare one-offs, yes. There's always going to be something crazy like that happens, but it is very rare.
So what percentage of the population is now unvaccinated?
The Washington state vaccine rates for kindergarten age children for 17 and 18 is 86%. But the goal and the target of the state's 95%. So we're well below that. There are some states already that there's no personal exemption allowed. And that's like California and Vermont. Both of those already don't allow this. Our kindergartners exception rate, I think there's 4.7% of the kindergartners who claimed an exemption to at least one vaccine. Mm-hmm. So that's really the scarier picture. I mean, we're not talking just about measles. We're talking about all those diseases that have been eradicated because we've done such a good job at vaccinating. And now we look like we're going a little bit backwards.
And explain why that wouldn't just be a danger to the 4.6%, why it's a danger to others.
Because they go to school with other children and other moms that might be of childbearing age who could be pregnant. Children can't even get a measles, mumps, rubella vaccine until they're over 12 months old. So any little kid that comes to school day for their kindergartner or, you know, the grandchild and the grandparent and all these people, that is a danger for all the unvaccinated children who can't get vaccinated yet because they're not old enough to get the vaccine.
So there are people, in other words, this is not just a problem among the unvaccinated group. We could argue that if you don't want to get vaccinated, then, you know, and you take the risk, then that's your problem. What you're saying is this is a problem for a lot of people beyond that group.
Yeah, absolutely. People, there's so many unknown consequences. So if you personally want to make that decision for yourself, then maybe you shouldn't be out in the public with people who don't even have the opportunity to get the vaccine yet. So we have the vulnerable group out there being exposed by other children who chose not to do it. So I guess the big question is, should they even be in the classroom? I mean, it's hard. That's a hard question.
Let's tackle that. Should these people, I mean, you're saying this is an emergency now. Should these people be quarantined?
I don't know. That's a tough question. I think a lot of people would say yes. It is. It's serious. And there's support from the WSMA, the AMA, all the organizations are saying we need to vaccinate children for the greater good of all those unknown, vulnerable people out there that are the unintended consequences. And that's just really sad.
All right. Teresa Girolami is the president of the King County Medical Society. Dr. Girolami, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much.
Your daily dose of kindness now. It's about an immigrant-owned restaurant in Washington, D.C. It's getting attention for its policy for the homeless.
If someone says, you know, I need a free meal, okay.
He says, okay, if you come in, ask for a meal, you're going to get a meal for free. Kazi Manan, the owner of Sakina Halal Grill, started this about 4 years ago. ABC 7 spoke with one man who comes in twice a day. By now, Kazi knows many of their orders by heart.
We have now so many, they are like a regular, you know, guest. So we know them, what they want to eat. You know, some of them, they have teeth problems, and we give them just boneless chicken, tender one.
And he does it, he says, because it's his way of serving God, but also because he knows what it's like.
Once upon a time, you know, I was in a similar situation where I didn't have enough money to eat for next day, you know. You pass by a restaurant, but never be able to go in. Because when you don't have money, nobody's going to let you in. I'm trying to worship our Creator through food.
Kazi says his effort also breaks down the stigma and stereotypes of being homeless. His customers get to see that welcoming in the homeless, it can be a good thing.
Look at my life and look at my restaurant. If this looks dirty to you, and I want people to not have fear loving others and caring for others and sharing, because it's going to bring a joy to your life.
Last year, he estimates he gave away 16,000 free meals.
Wow. A lot of people eat their, paying customers eat there deliberately because they support his cause.
I would think there is a certain customer that would go, hey, I'm going to support this. Yeah. I'm going to go eat there and pay. Yeah.
Yeah. Time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Now, here he is from Sports Radio's deepest bench, James Osborne. Let's talk about King Felix, who's back at spring training in Peoria. He actually took questions from reporters yesterday. And, of course, everyone wants to know how he's doing ahead of the season. And is he getting used to his new role? And what will that new role be?
His new role is expected to be not the ace best pitcher of the staff. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were wondering, like, well, he really hasn't been very good. He hasn't been able to last long in games for at least a year, probably two. Could they move him to the bullpen? They did that once. It didn't work out great, and then they had a need in the rotation, so they put him back in. Now, entering this offseason, a lot of people wondered, could they put him back in the bullpen if he's not going to be that great? And the answer is, the Mariners aren't really trying to win every single game and make the playoffs this year, so they're going to let him, be at the back of the rotation with low expectations, and see if he can regain some of the ability he had in the past and turn into a guy that just gives you five solid innings.
And how is he handling this?
Well, as most star athletes do, he's not handling it in the particular, like, I'm excited for my new role. He's more in the mode of thinking, everyone doubts me, and I'm going to go out and prove people wrong. I'm going to show you that I am who I used to be, that I'm still going to be one of the best pitchers in the game, because that's in me somewhere, and I'm going to do that. Where we find the gap between what he believes and what we see and know, that's the chasm that nobody knows how to cross, and I don't know
healthy,
if he does either.
As long as he doesn't take it out on his team or have an edge to him that isolates his fans, I mean, that's a healthy reaction. Oh, you don't think I'm good enough? I will show you.
Yeah, and athletes love that. That's something that athletes feed off of. If you remember the Seahawks teams that came to prominence, everyone told them they weren't going to be any good because they weren't a vaunted offense in the 2010, 2011, 2013, and it was some of that doubting, some of that disrespect that fueled them to play harder in a lot of ways. And so this could be it for Felix, but then again, he's experienced this kind of doubt for 3 years in a row now, and those results keep getting worse.
I was talking with Rick Riz yesterday about what he would have to do, and it seems to boil down to you can't throw 100 miles an hour anymore, but you can still have a pretty decent pitching career throwing 92 miles an hour and 86 miles an hour if you know where to place the ball, right?
Exactly. Play. I mean, location, speed, and movement are kind of the three things that would
Instead
make a pitcher
fanning
good.
People, you can force them to hit easy grounders and stuff
yes.
like that, right?
Yes, and for a guy who's made his career striking guys out, and that's what made him famous and popular, it's difficult for him to think about doing it another way. Just getting outs is a part of being great. That's not what he's done in the past, and it's not what he really wants to do, but when is that light switch going to flip and say, okay, I'll do that. I'll make it through six innings with striking out two guys instead of making it through three striking out six.
Now, you had just said that the Mariners management has said, okay, we're not trying to win a lot of games, make the playoffs this season. So what are we watching for in this team as spring training gets underway?
Yeah.
Can we call it spring training at this point?
Yeah. Pitchers and catchers have reported. Oh. So all the pitchers and catchers are there. The players will get there on Friday. So then everyone will be there. The thing that we're watching for as a real deep Mariners fan is watching some of the young guys that they acquired and they're developing, because they're going to be the next stars. The guys that the Felix Hernandezes of the future are the ones that are going to be here. You haven't seen them on a major league field. Guys like Justice Sheffield come in from the Yankees with really high expectations of what he could be. A guy like Yusei Kikuchi, he came over from Japan. He was considered to be one of the top 20 free agents in baseball, and he ended up going to the Mariners because he felt like the Mariners were a place that really needed him. And so if he shows that he can adapt to the major league game, he's still relatively young, like 26 years old. In 2 years, he could be the headliner of a staff that features a bunch of young talent that you haven't seen on the field yet. So
he
that's
came here because
for.
He feels bad for us?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We were hoping that Shohei Ohtani a couple of years ago would have done that.
Right.
He didn't, so we kind of get the lighter
version.
He chose
the business transaction.
Yeah.
We're getting the emotional transaction.
That's right. And you know what? We
refreshing.
Take what we can get.
Yeah.
Does he bat, too?
No, he doesn't bat. Unfortunately, he doesn't bat. But he is left-handed. He does sling it pretty hard. He throws up to 98 miles an hour. He could be fun to watch.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So the we're not calling this a it's a step back year.
Yeah, step back.
What does that mean?
That's a euphemism for rebuilding.
Rebuilding. Okay.
Yeah, we're not rebuilding. We're stepping back to rebuild.
Why won't they say rebuild?
Rebuild has a connotation of don't pay attention to us for 3 to 5 years because we're trying to lose and get
Isn't
better
that
draft
what,
picks.
Which team did that? Houston was it? Or
yeah,
it was Houston.
Houston
just blew
did
it up, and
the White Sox did it a couple of years ago too.
And it
it's
works.
A common thing in baseball for teams to say, you know what? We know we're not going to win with this group of people. We need to spend less money so we can save it and then spend it once our young talent is really good. And then we can all just kind of put all our chips in the middle at one time. It's a very common strategy in baseball. And the Mariners are kind of doing a shortened, abbreviated version
Do you
of that.
Think it's foolish for the Mariners this far into we're not making the playoffs, we're not making the playoffs, to just not rebuild?
I think that they're one transaction away from not rebuilding. If they were to trade Mitch Haniger this offseason, I would say they've completely rebuilt. They got rid of all their good players
and
that have value.
And they need to acknowledge they're rebuilding.
I'm on the edge of that. I'm like standing on the cliff looking at that option and saying I'm about ready to jump. But I'm going to trust that, I don't know why, but I'm going
to
trust that this little miniature
blue.
Version. Yeah, I'm true to the blue. This miniature version is going to work.
Okay.
James Osborne joining us from Brock and Salk at 710 ESPN. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News, this is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And now, straight from the Your Last Meal podcast, here is Rachel Bell.
Oh, hi, Dave.
With some reflections on why we drink the milk of other animals.
Yes, this is something that I hadn't thought about until about a year ago. It's so normal to go to the grocery store and pick up a gallon of milk.
Yes.
But if you told someone that you were going to drink someone else's breast milk, they would wince and they would tell you you were disgusting.
Yes.
But we drink the breast milk of cows all the time. So for the latest episode of my podcast, Your Last Meal, I interviewed a guy named Mark Kurlansky. He is the author of the new book. It's called Milk! ! A 10,000-year food fracas. And I'm going to start out, before we get into the other animals, in this society, we treat people who are lactose intolerant as if something is wrong with them,
mm-hmm.
when in fact, they are the normal ones.
There's an enzyme in the intestines that gives us the ability to digest lactose, which is a sugar, in milk. And we're pretty much all born with this enzyme. If you're not, you're in big trouble. But we generally keep it for about 2 years, and then it disappears. And then we no longer have the ability to digest milk because we can't digest lactose. So that's called being lactose intolerant, which is a name which sort of suggests a disease, but it's actually the normal condition. And only about 40% of people hang on to this enzyme and can keep digesting milk, and we're the abnormal ones.
So that means that 60% of the population on this earth is lactose intolerant. We're not supposed to be drinking milk. For some reason, that enzyme has stuck around. So he talks about why we started drinking the milk of other mammals in the first place.
I would have loved to have been there. Nobody knows exactly when this happened, but at some point, there was a baby whose mother had died. Her mother couldn't produce milk. And so, you know, the baby was in trouble and needed to get milk. And what do we do? And somebody said, hey, what about that goat over there? That was an amazing moment.
So we drink cow's milk for the most part, but Mark says that that is not the best choice for humans. That's what most experts agree. If you think about it, breast milk is the perfect food. When
right.
you have a baby, they don't even drink water. They only drink breast milk. It has every single thing they needed. It. We also talk about in the podcast that milk is a medicine. So something magical that happens is when the baby latches on, if they are getting sick or they are sick, some of their bacteria goes into the mother, tells the mother,
it signals
the baby is sick.
Wow.
Right in that moment, the mother's body makes some antibodies, sends them back through the nipple into the baby's mouth, so it becomes a medicine. So we're drinking cow's milk. They are a different species. They have four stomachs. We only have one. It just doesn't make sense for us. But the reason we drink it is because they produce a lot of milk. So Mark says that to keep any kind of livestock, it's very expensive. So if you're going to take care of this animal, you want to get your money back. And cows produce a lot more milk than goats, which actually would be a better choice, even though it's still not close enough. Yeah. They actually think that donkey milk might even be closer for us. But again,
it's
just
a tough sell.
It would be. It would be. But anything would be a tough sell because it all sounds weird. And it is weird. And drinking cow's milk is weird, too. But I'm also an adult who loves milk. And at this point, whenever I order milk at a restaurant, my friends look at me like, what are you, 4 years old? But I love it. I think it tastes so good with so many things.
Well, Bailey's Irish Cream has milk in it, right?
It does. But I think that the booze makes people think it's a little more adult than just a glass of milk with your pizza at night.
That makes sense, though, because obviously the human body realizes you need milk as a child. But then after the age of two, you really don't. That means I have to stop mocking people who are lactose intolerant.
Unfortunately, I know. That's the worst part. I love making fun of people who are different than me.
Actually, I never mock people who are lactose intolerant.
Well, not to their face.
Good advice, Rachel.
When Sean DeTore, who's one of our board ops here, when we hang out outside of work, he is lactose intolerant and he'll come over and he's like, okay, I'm bringing all of my, like, what are those called? Like the lactaid pills or whatever. And he leaves and like a wake of lactaid pill wrappers are on my floor so that this guy can just, you know, eat a little bowl of mac and cheese.
I think he should stand for his rights now that we know the facts.
I think so too. We should do a 5K in his honor.
Rachel Bell, thank you.
Sure. And listen to the podcast. It's called Your Last Meal. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or at yourlastmealpodcast.com.
I would like to bring awareness to the plight of lactose intolerance because I recently, in the last year, realized I've become lactose intolerant.
Really?
Yes. And I didn't know that you could just suddenly become lactose intolerant in the middle of your life. But it happened, and I'm here, and I'm not afraid to speak out, Dave.
You seem okay to me.
That's because I also take digestive enzymes just so I can process the foods that I love.
And I'm glad you've finally gone public with that.
Thank you. It was a really hard decision to speak up about this. But, you know, in the face of people like you who are constantly nagging on lactose intolerance, I would just like to say that I'm here and I'm here to stay.
When's your 60 Minutes interview?
It's coming up. No, I really
I will not stand for intolerance of any kind.
You should. If you... think. I didn't know this, so that's why I'm bringing it up, because if you think if you have bloating, pain, you know, that it's not just a one-off thing, you should look into, are you lactose? I think more people are lactose intolerant than we realize.